Chapter 10. Saturday, May 7th to Thursday, May 12th. Blomqvist put his laptop case on the desk. It contained the findings of Olsen, the stringer in Göteborg. He watched the flow of people on Goethegarten. That was one of the things he liked best about his office. Goethegarten was full of life at all hours of the day and night, and when he sat by the window he never felt isolated, never alone. He was under great pressure. He had kept working on the articles that were to go into the summer issue, but he had finally realized there was so much material that not even an issue devoted entirely to the topic would be sufficient. He had ended up in the same situation as during the Wennerström affair, and he had again decided to publish all the articles as a book. He had enough text already for 150 pages, and he estimated that the final book would run to 320 or 336 pages. The easy part was done. He had written about the murders of Svensson and Johansson, and described how he happened to be the one who came upon the scene. He had dealt with why Salander had become a suspect. He spent a chapter debunking first what the press had written about Salander, then what Prosecutor Ekström had claimed, and thereby indirectly the entire police investigation. After long deliberation, he had toned down his criticism of Boblansky and his team. He did this after studying a video from Ekström's press conference, in which it was clear that Boblansky was uncomfortable in the extreme, and obviously annoyed at Ekström's rapid conclusions. After the introductory drama, he'd gone back in time and described Zalachenko's arrival in Sweden, Salander's childhood, and the events that led to her being locked away in St. Stefan's in Uppsala. He was careful to annihilate both Teleborian and the now-dead Björk. He presented the psychiatric report of 1991 and explained why Salander had become a threat to certain unknown civil servants who had taken it upon themselves to protect the Russian defector. He quoted from the correspondence between Teleborian and Björk. He then described Zalachenko's new identity and his criminal operations. He described his assistant Niedermann, the kidnapping of Miriam Wu and Paolo Roberto's intervention. Finally, he summed up the denouement in Gosseberger, which led to Salander's being shot and buried alive, and explained how a policeman's death was a needless catastrophe because Niedermann had already been captured. Then the story became more sluggish. Blomqvist's problem was that the account still had gaping holes in it. Björk had not acted alone. Behind this chain of events, there had to be a larger group with resources and political influence. Nothing else made sense. But he had eventually come to the conclusion that the unlawful treatment of Salander would not have been sanctioned by the government or the bosses of the security police. Behind this conclusion lay no exaggerated trust in government, but rather his faith in human nature. An operation of that type could never have been kept secret if it were politically motivated. Someone would have called in a favour and gotten someone to talk, and the press would have uncovered the Salander affair several years earlier. He thought of the Zalachenko Club as small and anonymous. He could not identify any one of them, except possibly Mortensen, a policeman with a secret appointment who devoted himself to shadowing the publisher of Millennium. It was now clear that Salander would definitely go to trial. Ekström had brought a charge of aggravated assault in the case of Mago Lundin and aggravated assault and attempted murder in the case of Carl Axel Bodin. No trial date had yet been set, but Blomqvist's colleagues had learned that Ekström was planning for July, depending on the state of Salander's health. Blomqvist understood the reasoning. A trial during the peak vacation season would attract less attention than one at any other time of the year. Blomqvist's plan was to have the book printed and ready to distribute on the first day of the trial. He and Malm had thought of a paperback edition, shrink-wrapped and sent out with a special summer issue. Various assignments had been given to Cortez and Ericsson, who were to produce articles on the history of the secret police, the IB affair, and the like. He frowned as he stared out the window. "It's not over. The conspiracy is continuing. It's the only way to explain the tapped phones, the attack on Annika, and the double theft of the Salander report. Perhaps the murder of Zalachenko is a part of it too." But he had no evidence. Together with Ericsson and Malm, he had decided that Millennium would publish Svensson's book about sex trafficking, also to coincide with the trial. It was better to present the package all at once, and besides, there was no reason to delay publication. On the contrary, the book would never be able to attract the same attention at any other time. Ericsson and Cortez were Blomqvist's principal assistants for the Salander book. Karim and Malm, against his will, had thus become temporary assistant editors at Millennium, with Nielsen as the only available reporter. One result of this increased workload was that Ericsson had had to contract several freelancers to produce articles for future issues. It was expensive, but they had no choice. Blomqvist wrote a note on a yellow post-it, reminding himself to discuss the rights to the book with Svensson's family. Svensson's parents lived in Örebro and were his sole heirs. Blomqvist did not really need permission to publish the book in Svensson's name, but he wanted to go and see them to get their approval. He had postponed the visit because he had had too much to do, but now it was time to take care of the matter.